All right, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Chris Helm. I'm the Senior Product Manager for Windows Client Security. And what does that mean, as you're probably asking? That's a very large area. What that means is any of the security technologies that sit inside the Windows client or are shared in the server operating system, things like BitLocker, ALSR, DEP, access control, all these types of things, those are all kind of fall under my domain. When it comes to the manageability of security, things like System Center, we move that over to the server team and they cover that area. So it's really about what's inside the box and client, just to give you kind of an idea of the scope. And so thank you for coming to listen to this session. I think this is going to prove pretty interesting to you, because we're definitely seeing a shift in what's going on in the world, and there's new ways that you need to think about malware. And so we're going to show you how to protect the client and resources against threats. And the resources, I think, is really the new thing. We've got like a great new technology to protect the client against malware, but I think it's about protecting resources from malware that I think is where some of the new innovation you're going to see. So with that, one thing I would like to do it at the end, and this is based on feedback. How many of you attended the keynote this morning? Just so I know. So good amount of you. Okay. About 50% of you attended the keynote, and I showed a quick demo of some of the biometric stuff. I went through it very, very quickly, and a lot of people have been asking questions. So I'm going to take a little bit of the end of this presentation, without cutting anything short on the rest, to show you some of the things we're doing there, because I think that's pretty interesting stuff. So I'll save that for the end and make sure we have time for it. But with that, let's get into the details here. So the way the agenda is laid out for this presentation is we're going to talk about the key investment areas for securing Windows 8. And of course, it's the core, the boot, and the resources themselves. Then we're going to tell you about how well have those investments paid off. We've just recently got some information that shows the difference between 7 and 8. And there's a pretty dramatic difference when it comes to malware resistance on 8 and 7. And we've got some proof points there that will be pretty interesting to you. And then it looks like we're also going to show you some of the biometric stuff, since it sounds like everybody's interested in that. So why is 8.1 better than 8? So let's get into details. So Windows has a long history of security. You'll probably remember in XP time frame, we ran into a big disaster, right? We had Code Red, Slammer, all these terrible viruses came, and we were not prepared for them in Windows. And so XP SP2 set the record straight moving forward, right? So we made a tremendous amount of investments there. We added a firewall. We added all sorts of new technologies to deal with these threats that, as I said, we weren't prepared for. And then we did Vista. And Vista was not a successful operating system. From many aspects, commercial aspects, as far as revenue and whatnot, but what it was very successful at was security. Now, there were some challenges with the security, but architecturally, we made all the right decisions, and the architecture stands today. So we did the right thing. We broke app compatibility, and we paid a price for that, but I think we did the right thing security-wise in Vista. We fixed all those challenges in 7, and 7, I think, rounded off the rough edges on Vista. And some of the challenges we had there with drivers. And then, of course, now we're at 8. And the point we're trying to make here in this slide, other than, I think, the things I've mentioned, is look at the progressive additional levels of security. With each release, we delivered more and more and more. And what we've done is we've staffed the team that does security at Microsoft with more headcount every release. And, in fact, when we staffed it for Windows 8, I don't have the exact numbers here, but what our goal was is to deliver almost as much security new capabilities we did in several generations of the operating system in the past, all in one release. So we see that security is one of the key assets to Windows 8, and Windows it has been for a while. And so we've made some big investments, and we'll talk about those here in detail. But I just wanted to give you an idea of the history. So when we think about security at Microsoft, and we come up with a mental model, which is how we approach the problem, we break things up into these categories. Malware resistance is one we're going to talk about mostly today, but that's one of the key pillars. Protecting sensitive information, things like encryption, that's the second. And then access control and authentication is a third. And with Windows 8, we needed to modernize it. It wasn't just going to be an incremental change. We really had to transform some of the changes. And we have a session later today at 5 o'clock that we're going to talk about some of those transformative changes that we've made. But the big hero in 8 was really the malware resistance area, if you look at where we made the biggest impact. In 8.1, it's actually access control. That's where we're putting most of our investment. But 8, it was malware resistance. And our story requires the wrong word. Our story gets much better, is much improved, because we've taken dependencies on new hardware. If you have Windows 7 devices and you run Windows 8 on it, you will be more safe than you were with Windows 7 on a 7 device. But you'll be even better off if you have a Windows 8 certified piece of hardware for a couple of reasons. First of all, it has UEFI, which we're going to talk about in detail in a little bit. And it also very likely has Trusted Platform Module. UEFI gives us a secure boot capability, makes the system immune to boot kits and these types of things. And Platform Trust Module, or Trusted Platform Module, gives us the ability to have a crypto processor that can secure secrets and certificates and encryption, these types of things. And so that gives you an idea of the investment areas. So let's talk about the challenges that we specifically wanted to address when it comes to malware resistance specifically. I think the one there in the middle, malware can compromise the PC before it starts. That was one of the big problems that we wanted to address because that's a big problem. If you can get malware in front of Windows or Linux or iOS or whatever the operating system is, you own that machine, right? It's no longer yours, and your ability to detect that malware is probably zero unless they make a big mistake. So this is a huge problem. There are other places to attack the boot process, but that's the best place if you're a black hat trying to deploy malware. The other challenge is malware will hide from the anti-malware solution. Now, if you're a boot kit, which is what I was just talking about, it's very easy to hide from the anti-malware. But if you inject yourself in the middle of the Windows boot process, you need to do a lot more work as a malware author to do that. But typically, the people who know what they're doing are able to hide from the anti-malware solution. So you have a system that looks happy. Green lights, everything's good, but guess what? Your machine is owned, and you don't know it. And so this is a huge problem. So those are the challenges we wanted to really address. And there are others as well, but those are the big ones. And so the story, as I mentioned earlier, starts with new hardware. So what is UEFI? Many of you may be familiar with it, but for those who aren't, UEFI, Universal Extensible Firmware Interface, that's not my name, that's an industry name. It's terribly long, obviously. Basically is a modern-day replacement for traditional BIOS. And so the challenge with BIOS is BIOS basically starts up the PC, it initializes devices, finds the master boot record, and then an operating system starts. And the operating system could be anything on a BIOS PC. There's nothing to guarantee that the operating system that you wanted to start will actually start. It could be malware, it could be your operating system. You don't really know, and BIOS doesn't care. It's just like, I just start some executable code, go do your work. So UEFI replaces BIOS, and from a security, it has all sorts of benefits actually, but from a security perspective, there's a feature you want to remember. It's called secure boot. And so secure boot gives us the ability to securely start the desired operating system, and malware won't start before the operating system that you want. And the reason why this works is UEFI has a database of signatures of trusted operating system vendors, basically. Their signatures are listed there. And when UEFI attempts to start a OS loader, if that signature on the OS loader either does not exist or it's not a signature that exists in the database, UEFI will not allow the PC to start. It will say, sorry, you can't start anything, and then you're going to have to go fix the PC, basically. But at any rate, secure boot is great in that it prevents the case where a boot kit can start before Windows. This feature is so important that we made it a Windows certification requirement. So all new PCs that ship with a Windows 8 certification include UEFI. So this is great news. So the next hardware component is TPM. Actually, let me step back. There was some controversy about a year ago that never seems to go away, because once something's on the internet, you can never get rid of it, it seems. And so every month or so, somebody asks me the same question. The same question is, well, is Microsoft trying to block other operating system vendors? Linux, of course, is the big concern from being on PCs. The answer is absolutely no. We have no interest in preventing Linux from starting on PCs. At the beginning, when we announced that we were going to have UEFI and secure boot with Windows, the Linux community was not prepared to do the same thing through their own operating system. And so there was a lot of banter on the internet, and there was some controversy, and conspiracy theories were out. Well, now we're signing the operating system loaders for a number of Linux providers, and their signatures are inside the UEFI database. And so Linux can start on UEFI databases. UEFI systems. And so if you have any doubts about that, the proof is in the pudding, as we like to say. You can start Linux on these devices. And there's multiple editions of Linux that support it. And there will be more in the future, because this is a good thing for everybody. Everybody wants this capability. So let's go to TPM. So Trusted Platform Module gives us a crypto processor gives us a hardware root of trust to basically secure secrets. TPM has been around for a long time, but it's only been in commercial devices. It's typically, until Windows 8, not been in consumer devices. It's typically came at a premium, so you need to pay more for this type of device, but that's all changing. So our goal for TPM is to make sure that TPM is in every single PC that ships. We're not going to achieve that goal this year, but we're going to get pretty close because Intel's Haswell processor creates the opportunity to have a firmware-based TPM solution on any PC, consumer or commercial. So you're going to see TPM showing up on devices. It's a firmware-based solution, so it's not a chip. It's a firmware-based solution, but it has all the security characteristics of a physical discrete TPM. So from a security perspective, I'm just as happy with either, to be honest. So Haswell's great for TPM. It's pushing it down to consumer devices. The other thing is, what about China and Russia? Many of you have heard that TPM can't be used in those countries, and I think a few years ago that would be absolutely true. Things are changing, and the reason why they're changing is TPM 2.0, which is the new version of TPM, includes a feature called crypto agility. Crypto agility allows the OEM to insert the encryption algorithm of choice for whatever region. So most regions in the world are going to be fine with AES. Russia and China have alternate algorithms that they may have OEMs put into those devices. It's up to them to work out with the OEM. Now, for you, what we recommend in the moment is that you should consult with your legal team to determine whether your devices with TPM can be used in those regions. But what we understand is there are very optimistic talks going on with China and Russian officials, and it looks like there will be official sanctioning in the near future. I don't know when, because I can't control those conversations, and they tend to be slow because government operates on a different set of priorities than we do, right? TPM is not their main concern, but we're very optimistic of the outcome, and it looks like we're going to have success. So we're going to be in a place very soon, we believe, where TPM can be used worldwide. But make sure today that you work with your legal team to make sure that you are in a good place. I know personally of several organizations who have had paperwork drawn up by Russian and Chinese officials that allow them to use TPM devices, and Lenovo is an example of an OEM that is now successfully shipping TPM devices to China. So we already know that this stuff's happening, but it's in a strange place still. So we just need a little more time, I think, to get it perfect. But anyway, so that's that. So what about TPM? In Windows 7, we only use TPM for BitLocker. In Windows 8, we are using it in a much broader set of scenarios. And what we're trying to show you with this slide is we're just trying to signal how important TPM is to Windows security. You know, a lot of customers said, well, if I'm not using BitLocker, I don't need TPM. Well, there's a long list of great features, some of which we'll talk about during the session, that require TPM. And so we are moving into a place where Windows is not physically dependent on the TPM, but is much more secure when it's present. So let's move and talk to how we're going to secure the code in the core of our product. So if you're familiar with Microsoft processes, we have a process called Security Development Lifecycle. This was built out of the chaos that happened in Windows XP. We realized that our developers did not know how to write secure code, and so we designed a process that would help ensure it to the best that humans can ensure anything. So this process helps us deliver successful code. We've gone through many iterations of SDL over the cycle from XP, SP2, to Vista, to 7, and now to 8, and it's become more and more mature. And our developers have become more adept at using this process. And I think we reached earlier this year, last year, Q3 of 2012, Kaspersky for the first time did not list any Microsoft products in the top 10 list of products that had vulnerabilities. And so we never wanted to ever be in that list, but if you were to count the lines of code and any of the software was in that list, Office, Windows, et cetera, and you counted the lines of code in the products that are still on that list, it's actually a miracle that we ever could have got off of the list. We have more code than any of the other products probably combined. And so this, I think, really speaks to how good we've become in delivering software that is less likely to have vulnerabilities. But the reality is guess what? We have humans writing code, and there will be vulnerabilities, and we will issue security patches for Windows 8 and 8.1. We already have for 8. And so what we did in Windows 8 is we went to great lengths to create the condition where even if a vulnerability exists in the system, the likelihood that an attacker can successfully exploit it is dramatically less than on previous versions of the operating system. It was difficult in 7. In 8, it is magnitudes of order much more difficult. And the reason why is our two technologies that we've had for a very long time that we didn't make good use of. ALSR is one of those technologies. ALSR randomizes memory when processes allocate their blocks of memory. So that's one technique. The other technique is something called a data execution prevention, which allows a developer to say, of the memory I'm allocating, these portions are where executable code can exist, and this portion here is read-only. So you can imagine if I use DEP on the memory of my process, and I basically say that, you know, maybe 80% of it is read-only, that's 80% of my process memory space that can't have a vulnerability, or excuse me, that can't have an exploit put into it that can be executed. So DEP is very important to our story. And in Windows 7, we used it only in a few places. In Windows 8, we use it everywhere in core. And then if we go back to ALSR, which we had in 7, which randomizes memory, we've increased the level of entropy many times in some cases. Some cases it used to be 8 bits, and now in some cases it's 32 bits of entropy. So if you do the mathematics on that, you'll see that that is a magnitude of order more random. And so the likelihood that somebody could use heap spraying techniques and other techniques to insert their malicious payloads into memory and then get successful execution without crashing the system or the process is really, really, really low compared to where we're on 7. So this is not to say that there won't be exploits, but this is to definitely say that there will be fewer of them theoretically based on these type of investments, because we think we've raised the bar so high. Chris Valasek is a person that many of you probably know. He speaks at Black Hat. He's a security researcher, very high level of notoriety in the industry. He's basically a professional hacker. And he said two things that I think are interesting. One, he said the security advancements from XP to 7 are leaps and bounds, but 7 to 8 is just as great. And so that kind of makes sense based on the way we provisioned resources and funds. We tried to deliver as much new security capability in 8 as we did in all those previous operating systems. And he pretty much said the same thing. And he's a professional. He understands this stuff. The other thing is he said is this is a guy who hacks. He knows how to exploit things. He said he would never want to be tasked with creating a heap exploit for Windows 8 because he knows that he's going to bang his head against the wall for a long time before he can do that. In fact, what we're seeing is that rather than being a very smart individual who can exploit ALSR and DEP and exploit vulnerabilities, it really now requires a much higher IQ and maybe multiple people, maybe a team is required. And that doesn't mean that a smart individual will never hack the system, but it's going to be far fewer of those people around. So good news there from a vulnerability perspective. So let's talk about how we secure the boot. So we talked about UEFI. And so UEFI gives us a secure boot. And so this chart here kind of shows the way the system used to work. BIOS initializes devices, and it starts an OS loader. Potentially it's malware. And then the operating system starts, and then malware is running in the background. When we go to a UEFI, a modern boot, we have native UEFI. We have a verified OS loader. We know it's not malware. We know it hasn't been tampered with. It hasn't been changed, right? Because if you change a signed binary, that breaks the binary, and it won't start. And we know that Windows starts first. The other thing is that we have here is, in fact, I'm going to go to the next slide, is UEFI, of course, now is a point of attack. So if I can't compromise the bootloader, maybe I can hack on UEFI. Maybe I can put malicious firmware in there. Well, UEFI only takes signed firmware. So some of these attacks that we've seen on BIOS don't work in this case, right? It requires that you sign your firmware, and then you have to install it on UEFI. Another thing that hackers have done in the past when it came to BIOS is they would roll back the firmware to a previous version. So let's say that BIOS required signatures. And let's say there's a vulnerability in version, let's say, 2.0. So the fix comes in 2.1, and the customer moves forward to 2.1. Well, the attacker rolls the system back to 2.0 and then exploits the vulnerability. UEFI never goes backwards. You can only install new versions of the firmware moving forward. So the rollback hack that we've seen happen on option ROMs and UEFI itself, those are all gone. So we now have a secure startup with UEFI. We know that the Windows OS loader is going to start, but we need to protect much further than that, because that protects against boot kits, but not root kits, which start during the boot process. So somewhere in the middle of Windows as it starts, they try to insert themselves. So on Windows 7, we have maybe third-party drivers. So if I can't hack the OS loader, what I probably would do is I'd try to install a malicious kernel mode driver that has high level of privilege, and I would then tamper with the system that way. To address this in Windows 8, we have a feature called Trusted Boot. Trusted Boot picks up the first bit of code that starts when the OS loader starts is Trusted Boot, and it ensures that everything that starts after it is trusted, signed by Microsoft, et cetera. And so this prevents these malicious drivers from inserting themselves in the boot process and then attacking the system that way. In addition to protecting the Windows part of the boot process, what we do also is we have a special position in Trusted Boot. It's called Early Load Anti-Malware. And so what Early Load Anti-Malware is a type of anti-malware driver that can be inserted into the boot process. And so we protect that as well. So in the old world, if you didn't you'd install a malicious driver, the malicious driver would tamper with anti-malware solution. With Trusted Boot, because we protect the anti-malware solution, it would be very difficult to tamper with anti-malware solution. So now it starts securely, and its ability to protect the system is enhanced significantly. In fact, it would be very difficult to insert a malicious driver that even starts after Windows is booted into the system, because ELAM scans all drivers, and now you know it's running. And so it's important. The earlier you can start in the boot process, the more likely you can defend with your defenses. So we got UEFI Secure Boot. We have Trusted Boot protecting us. So let's talk about how we secure the sign-in. Because of some of the features that I've just discussed, we're seeing people move away from malware. Malware will still be a problem. People still create malware, but now it's all about identity theft. Stealing identities and passwords is actually becoming easier than installing malware on PCs on the Windows platform. And so there's a number of new sign-in options in Windows. And you know, this is more of an access control thing, but I want to give you some visibility to this. A lot of you have asked questions about, well, what about this picture password? Is that secure? What about PIN, et cetera? What I've done is I've talked to a number of customers, and when it comes to using a PIN for sign-in, with six digits, you're looking at 1 million possible combinations. At Microsoft, we use 8, so it's a much larger number. It's 100 million possible combinations. If we look at passwords, non-complex password is 208 billion possible combinations, and then passwords are, 8 trillion, that's 8 trillion combinations. And so for picture password, the one that everybody is worried about, that's how many combinations you have on a picture password. So if somebody is to find a device and try to randomly guess, assuming they don't have a horrible picture saying click here, click here, click there, that's how many potential combinations. The thing that makes the picture password weak, though, is you can see somebody typing it. And so if you wanted to target somebody specifically, it would be very easy to see what they put in as a picture password, whereas a PIN might be more difficult because you can very quickly go through and type a PIN. So there are trade-offs here. I think if you're not worried about targeted attacks where somebody looks over your shoulder and looks at your picture password and then steals your device, if that's not your concern, I think picture password is okay. It's not great, but it's okay. If you're worried about theft, if you're like the Department of Defense or a military where you know people are targeting you, I would not recommend using picture password. I would instead recommend we use something else. Now, there are some things you can do to mitigate attacks, an improvement that we have in Windows 8. In Windows 8, Windows 7, we had a feature called account lockout. So if somebody tried to brute force your password, we would lock the account. Right? It would be locked out for some duration, and then they could try again. And so that really broke the brute force attack. It could take literally forever to get into an account that way if you didn't have any knowledge about the user or the password. We've improved it in Windows 8. If you're using BitLocker to protect your volumes, you can use BitLocker anti-hammering capability to basically brick the PC if any attack on any account is executed. So if somebody tries to log into to your account and maybe does 5 or 10 password attempts, you get to choose how many. It would reboot the PC into a recovery mode, which would then require a 48-digit password to unlock the PC. So it's not a brick technically, but from the bad guy's perspective, they would be better off just wiping the PC because they'll never hack through that. It would take incredibly a long time to get through that. So that's good news there. But I think the best solution is really moving away from passwords completely. How many of you are familiar with Matt Honan's article from Wired Magazine, Kill the Password? Maybe a few? Okay. Maybe this was a more popular article in the United States, but this really caught our attention, and it's going to catch your attention here as well, I think, as I describe it. Basically, what happened to Matt Honan is he had his account hacked, and it was interesting what happened. He had an account at Amazon, and so the way, and this has all changed, so they fixed, Amazon and Apple have fixed their practices, but what happened in Amazon is when you called in and you wanted to make changes to your account, they would authenticate the user. If I wanted to reset my password, they would authenticate me with my name, and they would also authenticate me with the last four digits of my credit card. Right? That's the same thing that Apple did with their Mi accounts as well until recently. Well, what's interesting is at Amazon, what they did, if you wanted to add a new credit card to your account, what did they authenticate you with? Only your name. They would simply ask for your name, and in this case what happened is because these people understood the process, they added a new credit card, and then they called back and they said, I'd like to reset my password, and they said, what are the last four digits of your credit card? And of course, it was the ones that they just gave them to, a few minutes earlier. And so now they were into the app or the Amazon account. Then they, from there, were able to breach their Apple account. And then from there, they're able to get into Matt Honan's bank account. And they also are able to format his devices using a device wipe. And so his life was really bad that day. And so at any rate, he said, we need to move away from passwords. And we totally agree. We can't get away from them quickly because we've been using them for 40 years, right? These are deeply embedded into our practice and our systems. So we're taking a series of steps at Microsoft to get rid of them. One of the great steps is virtual smart cards. So this gives you two-factor authentication. And in this case, we don't have a password. We have a certificate that's issued to the PC. And then we model that certificate as a smart card reader and a smart card itself. And we protect it with the TPM so that the certificate can never be exported and misused. It's bound to the device. And then you have a PIN. So you have two factors of authentication, and we've moved away from passwords. So this is pretty cool first step because it gives you two-factor authentication, and it's electronically provisionable. Right? Name any other two-factor authentication option that's electronically provisionable. Right? It's not. Right? I have a smart card in my pocket as well. Many of you use maybe CAC cards or RSA or whatever. If you lose that device, you might not be able to get your job done. And so these are electronically provisionable, which makes them very attractive. The next step in our journey away from passwords is biometrics, which I'm going to show you at the end. You should be thinking about the two-factor authentication option of virtual smart cards as a way to protect you against malicious attacks. But let's see. Okay, so let's talk about how we're going to protect the system post-boot. In Windows 8, we decided for the first time to include an inbox anti-malware solution that was full-featured. We'd had an anti-malware solution before, but it was always a kind of a half-measure from an anti-malware perspective. Windows 8 now includes Windows Defender in every version of Windows. This is designed with the same capability as we see in the commercial edition, which is SCEP minus one feature, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But at any rate, it's a high-quality solution. There was an article about it, and it compared it against other solutions in the marketplace. And when they did that comparison, Defender actually received low marks. And so we were startled by this because we've done a lot of work on it. We're like, how could we be lower than the competition? And as all of you know, especially people in security, they always understand how statistics work. And so the view that this company took the incorrect way of approaching the stats that they had. The approach that we took in response to their claim, which was that the other solutions were about 20% better than ours, was that the malware that our solution didn't detect only affected 0.03% of our customers that we received telemetry from. So the viruses that they unleashed on our anti-malware solution weren't affecting people in the real world, right? But with that said, that's the reality. It's a bit of an excuse. But our goal, of course, is never to be in that position. And we're going to try to make sure that we never have that delta that we've had. But to be clear, 0.03% of customers were affected. So we're talking about pretty good anti-malware solution. But the other competition did do better than us. So we do have to give them credit for that. But anyway, the point here is that if you're looking at SCEP and Defender, you should definitely continue to think about that. When it comes to the firewall in Windows, we really didn't update that in 8. It kept up. There's some changes there, but we didn't make any big investments there. So it's pretty much the same fundamentally as it was before. What we have done, though, that is pretty dramatic is we have trustworthy applications in Windows 8. In Windows 7 and previous operating systems, we had desktop applications, and desktop applications can run with very high levels of privilege. Desktop applications have access to other applications. They have access to the system. They have access to all of the data potentially on the file system. And so when something bad happens with an application, such as a vulnerability exploit or maybe a piece of malware, they have a lot of capability on the system. And so we want to move most of our applications moving forward towards a new model. And that new model comes from the WinRT runtime, which is part of the SDK, not to be confused with Windows RT, the operating system. I apologize for the naming confusion. I wasn't responsible for that convention. But at any rate, WinRT gives us a really awesome capability from a security perspective. It creates a condition such that any app that comes from the Windows Store or is built on the WinRT at runtime and maybe sideloaded, maybe a line of business app that you build, is sitting in a sandbox. We call it an app container, but this is effectively a sandboxing technology. That application does not have access to the system. It does not have access to other applications except in the way that those applications have advertised capability to them. So the application can say, I will allow other applications to interact with me, but in a very, very specific declarative way. So it's not random like we have on a desktop app. For instance, if we have a dynamic link library in Office, for instance, any application on the system could access that DLL and attempt to use it. If there was a vulnerability, it could attempt to exploit Office even though with its own malware. So when we move to the new world, these sandbox apps have declarative ways of communicating with each other. And so this reduces the surface area of attack. In addition, these applications do not have access to your file system and your data. However, when you give them permission when you're running the application, such as file open, you give it limited access for the duration of the time where that application is running. So this is a superior model, and this will prevent a lot of the types of attacks we've seen. So we now have sandbox apps, and if you're running iOS and are familiar with the malware situation on iOS, it's pretty good. And why is it? Because they have a similar type of ecosystem. They have a store to vet applications for security, and they have a sandbox to contain their apps and prevent malicious activity. So we now have that capability in Windows as well. So let's talk about securing resources. And so this is kind of new. I think some of the things we've talked about so far are familiar to you, right? This is improvements on the things we've talked about in the past. But this is where I think things get new and interesting. So when it comes to traditional access control, we have an access control list that says, here's an object that I want to secure, and here's a list of users that should have access, right? And somebody needs to keep that list up to date. And something that the access control does not care about is the health of your device. If your device is full of malware, infected, owned, part of a botnet, you will probably still get access to all those resources when you log on the network if the malware has been undetected by the anti-malware solution, et cetera. So the challenge is that infected PCs are traversing your network. And what do they do when they traverse the network? They infect other PCs. They find your file servers, and they insert malicious macros in your files. They infect other PCs directly by exploiting vulnerabilities. They can do all sorts of different things to proliferate themselves. But that's the goal of malware, is to proliferate and propagate. And they do that because there's no notion of health of PCs in access control. It's just authentication. Does this user have access or not? So in a modern world, when you go to modern access control, we want to introduce the concept of the health of a PC when you access a resource. Now, some of you in the audience are thinking, well, this sounds like NAP, Network Access Policy or Protection, or NAC. It is similar in concept, but those are about your perimeter, right? Those are about preventing PCs from getting into your network, right? It's perimeter control. This is about securing resources inside. So this is very different. This is a natural kind of evolution of that. So the challenge that we have right now is Windows 8 shipped a capability called Measured Boot. And so what Measured Boot did is it took a series of measurements of all of the boot components. So when your PC boots, it takes a measurement of your UEFI firmware. It looks at the option ROMs and measures those. It looks at the OS loader, it takes a measurement there. All the drivers for Windows, pretty much everything in the startup process of Windows is measured and stored and persisted by the TPM. So there's no tampering of these measurements. These measurements can be used for integrity verification. But when Windows 8 shipped, there was no services out there that were taking advantage of this capability. It was really more of a platform feature, and our goal was to get people like McAfee and Symantec to build what we call a remote attestation service that would consume these measurements and then apply access control to the resources on your network. At this time, we don't have any tier one people providing that technology, right? What they're doing is they're waiting for more market share of Windows 8, and then when there's enough market share, it will become an attractive value proposition for them, and then they'll build these type of services. But there are some tier two, and then there are some solutions integrators that are building a remote attestation service. So let's go to the next slide, and I'll kind of talk about how the remote attestation works. In fact, let me move on to the next slide and actually show you this is the best way to talk about it. So for those of you who are not familiar with remote attestation, what remote attestation is the concept of a PC getting onto the network or starting on the network and a service on that network remotely verifying that that PC has integrity and hasn't been compromised. So it's remotely verifying. So in theory, this remote service could detect malware that maybe couldn't be detected locally because maybe the PC is too infected to do detection locally, right? We've all had experiences where you had to boot to a USB and get a clean OS and maybe clean a PC, right? Well, with remote attestation, we don't need to do that because our clean OS is this service. So the idea of remote attestation is remote analysis and then the issuing based on that analysis of what we call a claim. That claim is sent to the client, and that claim indicates that it's healthy or not healthy. The client then has this, and then as the client then connects to resources, the resources can be equipped with additional access control policy that says, okay, you not only do you have to authenticate with your username that I trust, you also need to provide me with a claim that indicates you're healthy, and then if it provides the claim and it's healthy, then access happens. So that's the concept of remote attestation. It's about remote analysis plus access control. So this is a solution that is going to be shipped to CodePlex. I'm just going to kind of explain how it works. It is a remote attestation scenario. This is something that if there's an organization like yours who wants to invest in building remote attestation services, you could use this code. And I have some solutions integrators that I'll mention here in a minute that can deliver this type of capability directly to you. So let's talk about how the scenario works here. So we have a tablet. This is a non-domain joined device that wants to access my corporate network. And so it's unmanaged. And so what they would do to engage in the network is they would go to a registration portal and they would register this device, this identity. The service for the portal would say, okay, let's go ahead and initiate the process. I want you to contact this ADFS server that includes these special extensions that we built for this proof of concept. So that's step three. Then, and of course, they authenticate to the ADFS server with their identity, so we don't want random people connecting. We want to make sure these are trusted users. Then what happens is the ADFS extension then contacts the attestation server and determines, okay, this is a new device that I've never seen before, so let's create a record of its existence, a record that we trust this device, and we'll use that a little later on in the service here. So then the client says, okay, it's a new device. Let's push our agent. We have an agent piece of code. This agent is what's going to harvest the measured boot data that we talked about and receive the claim later on that we'll talk about. So we install some client code. So that gets down to the PC. Okay. Then once the client is received, it's going to take an inventory of its measured boot data. It's also going to take a snapshot of the status of all the security systems in Windows. So it's going to go into Action Center and it's going to say, is my anti-malware solution running? Are the signatures up to date? Is my firewall running? Any of the security components, those get collected as well, sent to the service, and then that data just sits there in the database. In addition, in our demo, too, because we're very interested in helping people understand virtual smart cards, this POC also pushes a virtual smart card down to the device. So they're actually going to be logging on with a two-factor authentication option. And by the way, this is a non-domain joined device, which is pretty cool. So we didn't need to domain join this to push this card, this virtual smart card, and the certificate. This is a non-domain joined device. So periodically, the client will refresh its health status. And now let's talk about the connectivity and access to the resource. So the client is going to VPN into the network. And it's going to attempt to access the SharePoint site. The SharePoint site is going to say, okay, you need to provide the claim. I trust you as a user. You've authenticated, but I now need your claim. This message gets sent to the client. And in this case here, the device is going to request a fresh claim a new one with the latest information. It's going to send it up to the server. It's going to come back down. The claim token is issued to the client and then provided to the service. And now the service says, fantastic, you're healthy, you now can have access. And so now we have a situation here where clients that are unhealthy can access corporate resources. So this is a pretty powerful scenario. And we think that this is increasingly important because people are breaching your networks. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But we have a lot of evidence that people are being hacked at scale right now. So you need to protect the perimeter. You need to protect the client. You need to protect the resources. It can't just be perimeter defense anymore. So here are the companies who can help you if you're interested in remote attestation. Wave Systems is obviously a commercial company. They build prepackaged software. You can get a remote attestation service from them today. It's packaged software. We also can have custom solutions built for you by these four companies. This list will grow over time, but there's some pretty notable people here. Like we have General Dynamics. They do a lot of work with military and defense and government in the United States. So we have some very sophisticated solutions integrators who can help you build one for your network if you're interested. And so you should be thinking about remote attestation. I think it's going to take some time for people to get into a mode. It probably will take McAfee's and Symantec's to deliver these services until it goes mainstream. But if you're in defense, if you have secrets that you need to protect, critical information, this might be a worthy investment for you. Okay. So let's talk about how do all these features, when we put them together, how much better is Windows 8 security versus previous operating systems? This chart here came from the April edition of the Security Intelligence Report, which is a report that we build. It's a trustworthy computing group. We collect telemetry data from millions of computers, and so we have a very good view of what type of malware is out there in the environment. And this report slices things in two ways. We slice things by computers that are protected by an anti-malware solution, and also by computers that had an inoperable version of an anti-malware solution, meaning an anti-malware solution that maybe where its trial period had expired and it's no longer functioning, or one that didn't exist, didn't have anti-malware solution at all. So protected and unprotected PCs. And so when we look at PCs that do not have any anti-malware solution running and are just depending on trusted boot and secure boot and ALSR and DEP and all the things that are native to Windows, 2.7 PCs per 1,000 would have some sort of malware on it. When we compare that versus Windows 7, you'll see that we have a 3 times improvement on Windows 8. So you're 3 times less likely to have malware on a PC that has no anti-malware solution when we move to Windows 8. If we compare that versus XP, you're looking at over 5 times better. So that's pretty predictable, I guess. I think where things get really interesting, because who's not running an anti-malware solution except maybe on the consumer space? In the commercial space, you're always protected, hopefully. And so you see a dramatic drop, obviously. And we go down to 0.2 per 1,000. And if we go to Windows 7, it's 6 times more likely to get impacted by malware. And it's 21 times more likely on XP. So if you want to know why you should go to 8, well, there's the numbers right there. For malware alone, you have a huge, huge improvement. And it's because of this improvement that we see bad black hats moving towards identity theft instead of malware. And again, malware will continue to be something that they invest in, but the humans are easier to hack than the software in many cases now. So anyway, so we're pretty proud of these improvements. So let's talk about Windows 8.1 security and how we're going to get better. So before I get there and talk about those new features, and I'll have time for the biometrics demo, it looks like, I want you to realize that there are some big shifts in what we're seeing in the threat landscape. As I mentioned earlier, because malware is very difficult to deploy to PCs compared to the way it used to, black hats are finding it easier to steal your identity through fraud and certificate theft and these things. And so our view now is that there are organizations that realize they've been hacked, and that's been Microsoft and Google and Apple and Yahoo and RSA and the Los Alamos Research Facility in the United States where they do energy and defense work. And pretty much anybody who's a big shot when it comes to like Fortune 500 or defense has probably had a breach. And these are organizations that have nearly unlimited resources to protect themselves, and yet they can't protect themselves. And that's because We have very tenacious people who are going after these businesses. But we also have seen, and there's strong evidence of this, that now the weakest link is maybe not the Fortune 500 company. It's the 501 plus companies. It's the small businesses, the medium-sized enterprises, et cetera. They don't have the budgets. They don't have the expertise necessarily. And so they're also attractive targets as well. A lot of people think that only Lockheed Martin or Boeing or Airbus or these big, huge companies with these interesting technologies are getting hacked. Their organization, if you have credit cards records, you're an interesting target. If you have patient information, health records, you're an interesting target. And they're going to come after you. And if you're a small business, they may actually go after you first because you don't have the capability maybe to defend yourself. And they know that. And so that's why we're saying that you've probably been hacked and maybe just don't realize it yet. Because all of the big shots can't even protect themselves. And so there are these familiar threats that we've been fighting against forever, and we've been talking about them at every tech ed from the very beginning, and now there are these modern threats. And I want to emphasize the modern. We're seeing different threats today. And so the familiar is script kiddies, right? These guys are posers, right? They find a recipe on the internet, and they steal it, and they build a piece of malware, and they hope that it sticks out there, and they're not very sophisticated. They're definitely not computer scientists, but they may be computer science students, but they're not sophisticated. We have cyber crime, of course, so you're familiar with that. But now we're dealing with cyber espionage and warfare against all ranges of businesses. And we have cyber sabotage, right? It goes on and on. And so the familiar is cyber criminals. And when I say cyber criminals, I say it in kind of the old way, right? The old way is that they're small organizations trying to steal small amounts of credit cards. They're not large businesses that have full-time employees. They're kind of hacking rings, not particularly sophisticated from an organizational standpoint, but probably have some decent IQ on their teams to execute their malicious attacks. But now we're dealing with state-sponsored actors, and we're dealing with a new grade of cyber criminal. They're a well-funded, multi-million-dollar cyber criminal. They are dealing with very large sums of monies, and they have full-time employees with all ranges of talent that they need to execute their crime. We're familiar with attacks on Fortune 500, but as I mentioned, it's now all organizations are being target. We're familiar with software solutions to solve every security problem, but now you cannot be safe unless you have hardware-rooted trust. You can be safer with Windows 8 on Windows 7 hardware, but I think the threats that we're looking at that are going to happen at scale require UEFI. They require Trusted Platform Module. Right? You really need to be thinking about new devices. And I don't think we can expect that you're going to go replace all your PCs this year. But I would be thinking about accelerating the pace of PC replacement in my organization, or I'd be thinking about systematically targeting the most at-risk users. Rather than just spreading out the replacement cycle like butter, that you know every 5 years Chris Hallam gets a new PC, I would look at each employee and look at the roles they have. Do they have information that is highly confidential, and maybe they move to a 3-year replacement cycle until you can get them to the new technology. So think differently about PC provisioning, because the threats that are coming really require this new hardware. We're familiar with securing the perimeter, assume breach, as I've said a few times, and of course the familiar is, I hope I don't get hacked, but you will be probably. And so it's really about how well did you mitigate. And technologies like remote attestation that we talked about are great ways to mitigate some of these attacks. So let's talk about a couple of cool technologies here that are going to keep us secure in the future. So Windows 8.1 includes a feature codenamed Provable PC Health. It's a terrible name. But we're going to come up with a proper one later in the product cycle. We just haven't had time to come up with a clever name yet. But what this is going to do is this is going to help you detect malware that cannot be detected locally. I mentioned earlier a moment ago that we are waiting for big companies like Symantec and McAfee to build remote attestation services. We don't want to wait much longer in 8.1. We're going to deliver our own cloud-based service. It will not be remote attestation, but it will be remote verification. It will harvest the measure boot data. It will harvest the Action Center data. And we will be able to determine if that PC has a boot kit of the worst kind, the kind that can't be detected locally. And then we will inform the device and the user that they've been breached. And then they can then go through a remediation process. The natural evolution of a feature like this would be to become remote attestation, but we are not announcing that with 8.1. Possibly that's something that we would do later. Possibly that's something that we'll have third parties do. But we want to make sure that our PCs are malware-free, and we don't want to wait any longer. And so we've delivered this this service. The way this service works is that we have part of the Windows client now has an agent that's just part of the native code of the product. It sends this data to a cloud service, which analyzes it. It then sends a response to the client. And if the client needs to be remediated, the user or the device will have information indicating, here's how I get this malicious malware off of my PC. It could be use Windows Defender offline. It could be run push button reset. Hopefully it will never be melt your computer and never use it again. But we don't know of any viruses like that yet. But that's a potential option as well. I say that sarcastically, of course. And then another thing that I think is particularly interesting is that if the malware we detect on that PC has the potential to breach your Microsoft account or other accounts we have, we will let you know that as well. And that's a pretty cool feature. Because right now when you have malware on your PC, like a keylogger, most people don't remind you that, oh, by the way, you should reset every password that you've ever had because chances are that has been scraped by the malware. So we will let them know that they're at risk with their account. And we'll tell them how to remediate and approach that process. This is a feature that's fantastic for consumers. It's fantastic for bring your own device where you don't manage the device. You are commercial customers almost certainly, and you're probably wondering, how can I manage this? We don't have management of this with 8.1. So that's feedback we've been receiving, and we're thinking about that for the future. But I would encourage you to consider, you can turn this off if you choose not to. You don't have to run this service on the PC. I would encourage you to run it anyway, because this is going to detect a virus that none of your solutions can find on their own. And I think that you're better off with this than without it. So we will hopefully be able to make it enterprise ready down the road, but I would really think carefully about turning this off. I know some customers have told me, oh, I'm going to turn this off because I can't manage it. Please think carefully about that. Okay, a couple other improvements we have when it comes to malware resistance is we've made a big improvement in Windows Defender. Windows Defender now has network behavior monitoring. So if you're familiar with an anti-malware solution, it's always a race. Malware comes out, new signature. Malware variant, new signature. And it goes on and on and on and on and on and on. And the malware variants are not new malware. They're just binary differences. They just recompile it and make small changes to it. So they're fundamentally the same, and they have the same behavior. And so we now do behavior monitoring in Windows Client. And so when we see familiar patterns of malicious behavior, we can detect these even if we don't have signatures for it. And so this will give us a nice capability that will be great for consumers, great for BYOD, and even great for the enterprise as well. Because Defender Engine, of course, is included in System Center Endpoint Protection, and of course that functionality exists there as well. So a really nice addition to Defender. Another feature that we have is really actually not in Internet Explorer. Internet Explorer uses this feature. We've now added a new API in Windows that allows the browser to call the API when they receive a payload or code that should be executed in a binary extension. And so let me kind of mention how this works. So when you go to a website that requires ActiveX control, what happens is you go to the website sends the code to you, the code is immediately executed, and if it's good code, everything's fine. If it's malicious code, then we have a problem, and then hopefully the anti-malware solution picks that up and gets rid of it. So what we've done is, and that's kind of the wrong order of operations, don't you think? So what we've done is we've added an API that allows the anti-malware solution to scan the payload, the code, before it's executed with a binary extension. And so this is going to help us fight a number of types of attacks that we've seen. So this is a nice, I think it's an obvious feature. I don't think it's particularly innovative, but it's definitely a welcome feature that we've added to the product. So those are a couple of features. One last thing that we've done, and I don't have the time to go into a lot of detail, but there's two features. One's called protected process hardening. So today, in the core of Windows, we have core processes that are running for system. In Windows 7 and 8, there is the ability, if you know what you're doing as an attacker, to inject code into those binaries if you have a sufficient privilege. So a foreign code that's unsigned with the right access level can inject code and then infect the PC. This is a very difficult attack, but it can happen. What we've done in Windows 8.1 is we've added a feature called protected process hardening. Most of the core Windows services, including Windows Defender, by the way, cannot have code injected into them unless the process that's doing it is signed by Microsoft. So our central core to the operating system is much more secure. It's been hardened against a very hard attack, but it's kind of refreshing that it's better. Pass the hash is something that maybe many of you have heard of. It's a complicated attack, but basically once you have the hash, you can pass it to others and they can basically spoof you as a user is kind of the short story of that. It's really been a theoretical attack in the past, although some customers have experienced pass the hash. Most people just talk about it as a threat. And until Windows 8.1, we've never felt like we needed to prioritize this fixing this, right? And it was because it was somewhat theoretical and it was affecting few people. Because malware has become very difficult to provision and it's more difficult to be successful that, we think that pass the hash is something that these sophisticated cyber criminals and nation states would want to exploit at scale. And so we've added some capability in 8.1 to make that a much more difficult proposition for attackers. So that's a nice feature, very complicated. We could do an entire session on pass the hash. In fact, I think we had one this week. So there you have it. So that's the highlights of Windows 8 and also Windows 8.1 from a malware resistance perspective. I've got about 5 to 7 minutes to show you the biometrics piece that I wanted to go. So I'm gonna quickly jump over, since we have a little additional time, to this other device, which is number 5. So let me tee this up. So at the keynote, I mentioned that we're going all in on biometrics. And so as I mentioned earlier, smart cards are a step to move away from passwords. And there's a series of steps that we got to take. Step 2 in our process is biometrics. So biometrics allows us to stop using passwords, and we can now use our biometric identity. And so I have, I know it's hard to see here, but what these are 2 sensors. And just to give you a sense of scale, you know, here's my finger on one. So these are very small. The ones that will be shipping in devices later this year, early next, will be 9 by 9 millimeters. So very small, a little smaller than what you're seeing there. So they're very small sensors. They will be equipped on the palm rest of laptops. They'll be on tablets. They'll be on all-in-one PCs around the monitor, maybe on the keyboard instead. They will be on mobile phones. We're not disclosing which devices will include this technology because, to be quite honest, we're still working with the OEMs to see which type of devices are going to be able to equip this. I think we're going to see most of those devices appear next year. We may see a few this year. It's really a next year thing is when we'll really see these type of sensors show up in devices. But the beauty of this sensor is it's touch-based. The swipe sensor, how many of you have Lenovo computers or biometrics devices today that on your PCs? So very few of you, and that makes sense because the sensors are swipe-based. So I need to swipe my finger like this across the sensor, and the sensor is much smaller. It's like 9 millimeters by 3 or 4, so it's you know much smaller. But usually it takes me multiple tries to get it to work, and I need to go to a third party to get the enrollment software to enroll my biometric identity. And so what happens is most people never even use the sensor. Because I have to go to the third party, and then the sensor doesn't work that well, and most people get frustrated, and most people haven't invested in an enterprise management solution for it. It's just not a complete scenario. So with these new touch-based sensors, because they're so high quality and they're going to be affordable for the first time, this sensor here would be maybe $250 with the technology it has in it now. It's going to be closer to, it'll be below $10, closer to $4, US dollars that is. Because of the work we're doing and because these are going to be shipped at scale. It's no longer going to be hundreds of thousands. It's going to be hundreds of millions of these shipping. So the price is going to come down. And now when I want to sign in, I can touch. And in a second, I can get in. So if you saw the demo earlier today, and I can show you on this device here, 6. So let me wake up my PC here. Oops, I need to... All right, so I'm at the sign-in screen, and this, of course, is my daughter, of course. So I've got my hands here. I'm going to put my finger on the sensor, and in less than a second, I'm actually in. So this provides a super experience because I didn't have to swipe and try again. And it was just a great experience. It just worked exactly the way I should. And for this reason, we know people are going to use it for the first time because it works exactly as you'd want. Oops. But let me show you the other feature that we've added. So you used to have to go to a third party to enroll your finger, right? Well, now we include that in the box. So I'm going to go into PC settings, accounts, and sign-in options. I can add a finger. I can add all of my fingers. I can add 50 fingers. In fact, this device I'm using here probably has 20 different people's identities because we use this for demo. So everybody uses this. And when I add an identity, before it allows me to even add identity, it's going to verify my biometric identity first, because we don't want to assume that I don't have a malicious person who's just accessed my PC, right? We want to verify before we make a critical system change, before we add another identity here. So it verifies, are you truly the admin, or are you a person that saw that I didn't lock my workstation and now you're going to add yourself as admin, right? So we add that, and then to enroll it, I just put my finger down. Oh, I'm using the same finger. So if you've already registered the finger, it's going to say, hey, stop doing that. You already are registered. So I'll pick a new finger. I'm going to use this. I'm going to use my pinky. So I just hold the finger down for a few minutes. It took about 6 tries to get it. And that's because the driver on this is actually based on, this is by Validity, a US company. The driver hasn't changed from their swipe-based reader. And on a swipe-based reader, because it's not as precise, it requires about 5 tries to really make sure that you got it right. If I was to use the other device, this one here, from Fingerprint Cards, they updated their driver, and they just do, technically, they get the biometric identity in the first try, and then they do one more just to verify to make sure. So it's super fast to register, and now I have my biometric identity that I can use here. Now, privacy concerns always come up with this. I don't remember if I had time to talk about this morning. I only had 2.5 minutes to speak this morning. But from a privacy perspective, it's important to know that your biometric identity never leaves this device. There is no central storage in Active Directory of your biometric identity. That would be really cool because I could go to any device and use my biometric identity instantly there. But what would happen if somebody compromised your biometric identity? That would be a big problem, right? Because your finger, I can't revoke this, right? Once you've lost your identity, I'm not getting a new finger. It's non-revocable identity. So we don't store those in the cloud for obvious reasons. So that's good news for those who would have concerns about that. So let's see. What else can we do here? Let me show one more demo here. You saw this earlier, but I didn't have time to really talk about this. So we talked about using biometric identity for authentication. So I can sign into Windows. I can sign into my VPN. I can sign into a website using my biometric identity. That's obvious, right? I can do touch to buy. So I can go to the Windows Store and I can buy an application. And it can verify that I consent to the purchase, right? So I can have consent. This scenario here is about verifying user presence. So what happens today is when I log into my PC is myself. Every application on my PC assumes that it's me, right? I'm logged in with my credentials, and it doesn't ask me to re-verify. And the reason why is if it said, hey, I want you to input your password again, I would be not happy because it's a lot of friction. And I would select the little box that says, never ask me for my password again. And then I've basically turned off a security feature. But we can't depend on user presence because we all know that people use their PC and then they walk off for lunch and they leave their PCs unattended. We know that people steal our passwords, right? We know all sorts of things happen. And so what we can do with an application like this is we can add code so that when I log in as a physician, it's going to ask me to verify, okay, are you really the person who's supposed to be here? I'm verifying your user presence and not assuming that the person who logged on is actually there. And so this is great for this app, but I think where this is going to be really helpful is in banking apps. Imagine being able to trade shares based on the touch of your biometric identity. Imagine being able to have a true audit trail of the real person that did it, not the person who stole your password, right, and logged on and traded something or did something malicious with your identity, but to actually verify. I know that audit record really was that user because they used their biometric identity. So from a compliance and auditing perspective, this offers us a superior story that we have never had before we could use biometrics. And so that pretty much covers it. One last thing that always comes up is, well, why did you choose fingerprint biometrics? There's a couple reasons. One is it is almost the ideal biometric identity because it is truly unique. The devices to measure it can do it in a secure way. So these touch devices have liveness detection. They can detect the difference between a live person and a dead person. They can detect the difference between rubber and flesh. So the idea of using spoofing techniques, those don't work on these devices. They can detect moisture. All the things, all the attributes of a person full of life can be detected. And we're able to put these in a small form factor too, right? That's important, right? We want these in our devices. And so if I was to use, let's say, the camera for facial recognition, well, you know how big Kinect is, right? Kinect's a pretty big piece of hardware, right? And the camera you have here, even if it's 24 megapixels, I could just put a 24 megapixel image of yourself in front of that camera, and that would be you, right? So spoofing of cameras is going to continue to occur and is not good for biometric identity unless it has a high level of sophistication, 3D capabilities, thermal reading, all sorts of other attributes that would detect a real human being versus a non. And we can't fit those in a mobile phone or your laptop, et cetera. So maybe in the future that becomes possible, but in the moment that's not cost effective or portable. So that's why we chose fingerprints, because it's the ideal. So with that, we have about 10 minutes left in the session, and so I'd love to take your questions. We don't have a mic in here, and I think maybe we could get a mic to come forward, or we can have people speak loudly. So are there any questions for today? No questions. Okay. Let me see if I can propose a question. I think I covered everything. Who's going to attend the next session on Windows 8.1 security? It's 5 o'clock. Covers a little bit of what we talked about today. A little more detail on other things. No? Okay, a couple. That's good, actually, because I covered some of it here, actually, and so it wouldn't be completely redundant. You'll learn a lot of new things. But it's good that we'll have a new crowd who will experience 100% new content. That's a comment from me. Any real questions, though? Okay, it looks like maybe the mic's moving forward. In hope. Okay. Well, it doesn't look like we have any questions right now. I'm going to spend a couple more minutes up here kind of cleaning up. So thank you for coming to today's session. If you want to come forward and ask me questions, I'll clean up here real quick and I'll be happy to answer them. So thank you very much. I hope this was interesting. And I hope you take some of this back and improve your security within your organization. Thank you.